So my point is, real religion begins with awe, and awe morphs into reverence, respect, and into gratitude. When you have this gratitude, then you're filled, you're full up, thankfulness. So that's the real essence, I think, of being on this earth. It's being grateful for being part of this journey, 13.8 billion year journey, in a home of 2 trillion galaxies. You know, how could we ever be bored again? Our hearts should be exploding with gratitude, and that should shift our consciousness and our conversations, our dialogues and our debates about a creativity that has to follow.
Next on Progressive Spirit, I have a rebroadcast of my conversation with theologian, activist, and mystic Matthew Fox. Stay with us. For the Pacifica Radio Network, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit. ProgressiveSpirit.net. I'm John Schuck. In November, I released an interview with activist Matthew Fox. This is a rebroadcast of that episode. Matthew Fox was silenced by the Vatican for his views. He left the Catholic priesthood in the early 1980s. Matthew Fox is a theologian and activist who has written over 30 books. He's introduced millions of people to creation spirituality. His latest book, published in 2016, is called A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. According to Fox, Merton was assassinated by the CIA. We'll talk more about that, as well as have a candid conversation about ecology, human rights, capitalism, and resistance. Welcome to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
Thomas Merton wrote a letter to you with suggestions of where you should go for your theological education. You reprint that letter in your book, and you took him up on it, and you ended up studying in Paris. My question is, what was your relationship with Thomas Merton, and why did you seek his opinion?
Well, like many young Catholics in the 1950s, I read Merton as a teenager and was moved by him. And of course, in the 60s, which is when I wrote him in 1967, just the year before he was murdered, in the 60s, he had become a very prominent figure because, for example, he was the first religious figure in America to come out against the Vietnam War. He beat King to it. And King was a friend of his. In fact, an interesting story that came out in my research was that the weekend that King was murdered, he had been scheduled to go to Merton's monastery along with Thich Nhat Hanh. The three of them were going to have a joint retreat together at Merton's monastery. But the last minute, King backed out because of the garbage strike march in Memphis, and he chose to do that instead, which was, of course, a very fateful decision. But so Merton was just very involved politically and spiritually. Of course, he had a great depth of spirit because of his contemplative lifestyle there. So anyway, when my Dominican superiors said I could go to Europe to get a doctorate in spiritual, I said, great. And I decided to ask Merton about where to go. He said to go to Paris. And it's there that I met my mentor, Pierre Chenu, a wonderful, at that time, 75-year-old French Dominican, who was a founder, really, of liberation theology, because he came out of the worker priest movement with Marxists, unions and so forth after the Second World War. In fact, he was forbidden to teach or preach or write for 12 years by Pope Pius XII because he was so socially justice committed. But so Chenu named the creation spiritual tradition for me, and that changed my life and set me on my course. So I can rightly say that all the trouble I've gotten in since I returned from Paris is due to Thomas Merton, because he sent me there. So this book is kind of a payback.
That's good.
It's my thank you to him.
I was going to ask this question at the end, but I'm going to ask it right now because you started off by saying Thomas Merton was murdered. He died young, murdered at the age of 53. But this is the Wikipedia entry for Thomas Merton's death. It says, on December 10th, 1968, Merton was in Bangkok, Thailand, attending an interfaith conference between Catholic and non-Christian monks. While stepping out of his bath, he was accidentally electrocuted by an electric fan. End. That's the Wikipedia entry. But you, Matthew Fox, believe that wasn't an accident. What was he doing in Bangkok, and what do you think happened?
Well, he had just finished giving a talk entitled Karl Marx and Monasticism, which was not the most prudent title for a talk in Southeast Asia in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War, as you may recognize. He had been getting death threats for years from the FBI, and they had been then the CIA had tapped his phone and intercepted his mail, just as they did to King. And I have spoken to three CIA agents over the last 30 years who were there at the time. I said, did you guys kill Thomas Merton? The first one said, I will neither affirm it nor deny it. The second one said, we in the CIA at that time in Southeast Asia were flooded with money. There was absolutely no accountability whatsoever. If even one CIA agent felt Merton was a threat to the country, he could have had him done in with no questions asked. And remember that Merton was the mentor to the Berrigan brothers, who went frequently to his monastery for gatherings. And of course, the FBI were chasing the Berrigan brothers all over America. And so they knew that Merton was the mentor to these radical, though nonviolent, Catholic priests who went to jail frequently protesting the war in Vietnam and nuclear war in general. And then the third person I asked was this past year after my book came out. I said, did you guys kill Merton? And he said, yes. And he said, the last 40 years of my life, I have spent cleansing my soul from what I did in the name of the CIA when I was a young man in Southeast Asia. So I think it's a proven deal that Merton was murdered. For one thing, he was there in Bangkok at the height of summer. It was December 10th, that summer in Bangkok. And he arrived the day before, so certainly he had this fan on the day before, and it didn't kill him. So what is this? Why did it have this terrible short in it the next day after he'd given his talk, when he stepped out of his shower and supposedly plugged the fan in? Now, you and I would not step out of a shower soaking wet and plug a fan in the wall. And Merton was not an abstract kind of guy. He was very grounded. So I think it stretches credibility to think that he stepped out of a shower soaking wet and plugged the fan in, and that's what did it. Clearly, they did see that there was a serious short in the fan. But again, I say he must have used it before he went off to do his talk. And so I think it's very, very likely that someone snuck in there when he was speaking and did him in that way.
Yeah, something else I read, now I wish I had the source in front of me, but said that the door was actually had been forced open.
Well, that's interesting. I had not heard that detail, but that's a very significant detail. Yeah, I don't think there was much in the way, there was no autopsy. I don't think there was much in the way of detective work done on this, actually. They put his body on a plane, a CIA plane, along with soldiers who had been killed in the war, and flew him to Oakland. And from there on, they moved his body to Gethsemane in Kentucky, where his monastery was and where he resides today. His body lies today.
Well, and you mentioned you talked to somebody just since your book came out who said yes. Were they admitting it personally, or were they admitting that the CIA did it?
The CIA did it.
Mm-hmm. Huh. He didn't say anything more? That's very intriguing.
Yeah. Well, it all adds up. I think anyone with awareness of what was going on at that time in our country. That was the same year that King was murdered. It was the same year that Robert Kennedy was murdered. So, it was not a tranquil time in our history.
And that it wasn't certainly the last time that the U.S. government has gone after liberation theologians.
Well, that is so true. I lay that out in my book, The Pope's War. I have it all footnoted how the Reagan administration, 3 months after Reagan was inaugurated, there was a meeting in Santa Fe of the National Security Council, and it was like a 10-day meeting or something, and they were asking one question: how could we destroy liberation theology in South America? And they concluded that they couldn't destroy it, but they could split the church. So with that, they went after Pope John Paul II with satchels and satchels of cash to give to Solidarity, and in exchange, John Paul II would go after liberation theology in South America, which, of course, the Vatican did with vengeance. And they deposed, if you will, cardinals and bishops who were on the side of liberation theology, replaced them with Opus Dei, which is, of course, a profound fascist organization, which has infiltrated profoundly into American power places, CIA, FBI, Supreme Court, in other places. This is the way CIA Opus Dei is, and that too was something that flourished under Pope John Paul II and Cardinal Ratzinger, Benedict XVI, who came after them. So definitely, the Vatican has been very much on the radar of the right wing in America, and the Opus Dei has been a very strong part of that. I wrote a chapter on that in my book, The Pope's War, also. Of course, this new pope is different, coming from the Third World and being quite open to liberation theology. In fact, he's going to be canonizing Oscar Romero, who, of course, was murdered. He was despised by the Vatican, Romero was. So it's definitely a turnabout, and of course, you can see it in the press how threatened much of the power structure is in America when this pope comes out against Wall Street's excesses and the very nature of capitalism's excess. And of course, when he preaches ecology, as he did in his good encyclical Laudate Si. So the right wing goes crazy when the Vatican is not in lockstep with the politics of the uber right in this country, and Opus Dei is a good example of that. And the very bishops and cardinals that were appointed in that 34-year period under John Paul II and Benedict XVI, it's really scary. Many of them are Opus Dei, and Opus Dei is a purely fascist movement. It was started by a fascist priest in Spain in the 1930s, and it hasn't become less fascist over the years, I can tell you. And yet they were really running things under those two papacies, and you can see it even. And they appointed young. Like here, I live in the Bay Area. The San Francisco Archbishop is Opus Dei, and he's in his 50s. He's going to be around here long after Pope Francis is dead. And the bishop in Los Angeles is Opus Dei, and he's in his young 60s. So, you know, this has been happening under the radar insofar as the media tends to ignore these important signs of political and religious embeddedness that occurred for 34 years under those two popes, and that the Catholic Church will be paying for generations to come. So it's like stacking the Supreme Court. You know, these people are in leadership positions for decades.
I'm speaking with Matthew Fox. His latest book is A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. The Church, of course, in its various forms, has told us the way to God. In a nutshell, we're fallen from grace because of original sin. The good news is that we can be redeemed by Christ's sacrifice and then united with God in heaven. And you've been working on a way to God that's quite different. You've written volumes on creation spirituality, and you've paid the price for it in your own career as a Catholic priest and theologian, silenced by the Vatican. I want just to catch people up. If you're in the elevator, how would you contrast creation spirituality with the fall redemption model of default Christianity?
Well, I would say they're mere opposites of each other. Fall redemption theology is very patriarchal, and creation spirituality welcomes the feminist and the divine feminine, along with a healthy masculine and not a patriarchal masculine. Creation spirituality is, of course, acknowledging the holiness and the sacredness of creation. A good example of that is the struggle going on today up at
Standing Rock.
Standing Rock, you see. The whole question there is, how sacred is water? That's how the chief of the Standing Rock tribe put it. It's only about this. It's about the sacredness of water. And what is that in opposition to the sacredness of oil prophets? That's what it's in opposition to. So that's the struggle going on at this very moment, and it's always going on. And, of course, the whole environmental crisis is because we've lost the sense of the sacredness of creation. And so we've been going willy-nilly for centuries now in our anthropocentric, and what Pope Francis rightly calls our narcissistic commitment to human so-called progress at the expense of the rest of creation. So now the Fall Redemption tradition doesn't acknowledge the sacredness of creation. St. Augustine, who's really the father of that tradition, says that, and he's the one who invented original sin, by the way, in the 4th century. Jesus never heard of original sin. No Jew has ever heard of original sin. And so the tradition of original blessing, which is that of creation spirituality, is what is really in the Bible, and it's really the Jewish tradition, and therefore Jesus' tradition. So creation spirituality is not anti-Semite by any means. It's always trying to recover the essence of the Jewish tradition, and that's what Jesus was doing when he called for compassion, for example. Compassion being, in Judaism, the secret name for God. So creation spirituality is both mystical and prophetic, and by that I mean it both addresses the need for love and connecting to the whole of the heart, but it also is critical of social injustice, economic, racial, and eco-injustice, and calls us to act and to be critically about the issues of our time. And so creation spirituality is not anti-intellectual, whereas Fall Redemption is anti-intellectual. For example, the example obvious now is the whole fear of science, the ignoring of science when it comes to the environment, for example, or anything else, including the whole subject of homosexuality. That's not a biblical question. It's a scientific question. It's the Galileo case of our time. Science has spoken that 8% or so of the human species is going to be gay or lesbian and get over it. We've also counted 464 other species with gay and lesbian populations. So it's integral to nature, though obviously homosexuality is a minority, but it doesn't mean that it's unnatural. In fact, it's unnatural to demand heterosexuality of homosexuals. So there are many areas then in which these two traditions differ very, very broadly. And the whole tradition, what I've been showing is this isn't what should I say, a liberal perspective from the 21st century. This is found in the oldest traditions, our greatest mystics. For example, Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century said that revelation comes in two volumes, the Bible and nature. So there you have it. Nature itself is a source of revelation. But this is completely ignored by those Bible-thumping preachers who want to beat you over the head with a book that's only 2,000 years old. And while nature is 13.8 billion years old. So I think nature has a lot to teach us. And this is why science is so important, because scientists spend their lives trying to discern what are the real facts and the real mysteries in nature. So creation spirituality is very partial to incorporating a healthy science into our worldview. And the whole idea of the cosmic Christ is a wonderful archetype. It's mirrored in the East with the Buddha nature, or in Judaism with the image of God. But the idea that all beings contain the Christ, every being is another Christ, that's not how Fall Redemption sees it. Fall Redemption sees only Jesus as a Christ. But in Christ spirituality, we are all called to acknowledge the holiness of all being, including every one of us. And with that dignity comes responsibility.
Yeah, and this is important to talk about. You mentioned this isn't just a 20th century new kind of hippie theology, creation spirituality, right?
Right.
I mean, we're it goes back all the way to Amos and Isaiah. It's all the way through, perhaps underground. I don't know if that's the right word, but definitely a part of it. The church has condemned people throughout. If it hasn't been able to ignore them, it's condemned them, like Meister Eckhart, right? So
exactly,
and even Thomas Merton thought that Eckhart was a heretic or outside the Christian tradition at first, and he himself had to evolve from the fall redemption to a more creation spirituality viewpoint.
Exactly. He entered the monastery in 1940, and he himself. It comes through in his autobiography, which was a big bestseller in America, called Seven Story Mountain. He's very dualistic. He's very patriarchal. He's very guilt-ridden and shame-ridden in that autobiography. And then for the first 18 years of his monastic life, he was writing in that vein. But in 1958, he met Dr. Suzuki, the Zen master from Japan who brought Zen to North America. And Suzuki really converted him. He said, "You must read Thomas. You must read Meister Eckhart. You're one Zen thinker of the West." And Merton did that, and it shifted him entirely, 180 degrees. There's a different Merton from 1958 to 1968 when he died. And in those 10 years, he became very much a pioneer in opening up to the East. He wrote books on Zen. He wrote books on Taoism, on Sufism, and he became very ecumenical. And on that last journey to the East, he met the Dalai Lama, who at the time was only 32 years old. They really hit it off. And in fact, the Dalai Lama since has said that Thomas Merton is my spiritual father. And just this past year, the Dalai Lama was asked, "Do you believe in God? And if so, what kind of God do you believe in?" And the Dalai Lama hesitated, and then he said, "I believe in the God of Thomas Merton," which I think is a pretty fun endorsement from a Buddhist leader of great stature. But of course, Merton also became very close to Thich Nhat Hanh, who in fact nominated him for a Nobel Peace Prize after he died. Merton, his last year, is just writing in his notebook, "Eckhart is my lifeboat. Eckhart is my lifeboat." So Eckhart really converted Merton from being this dualistic, guilt-ridden, fall redemption monk to being a prophetic Christian, and who brought together his mysticism and passion for justice in the last 10 years of his life. And frankly, I think it cost him his life. So it's really a powerful story. And of course, Eckhart has been very important to me too. I've written 3 books on him, and I think he really is an amazing figure. For one thing, he is so ecumenical. My most recent book on him, I put him in different chapters. I put him in the room with Thich Nhat Hanh in Buddhism. I put him in the room with Kumaraswamy in Hinduism. I put him in the room with black elk and indigenous teachers and shamans. I put him in the room with Adrienne Rich and feminist thinkers. Put him in the room with Carl Jung, and Jung said he owes the key to the unconscious to Meister Eckhart. So Eckhart is an amazing figure. He's endorsed by Hindus and Buddhists and Jews who know him too. I put him in the room with Rabbi Heschel. So Eckhart is amazingly ecumenical, and yet of course he comes from the 14th century. But remember, the 14th century is pre-modern, and pre-modern consciousness, this is why I'm so drawn to Native American spirituality and to medieval mystics, because your pre-modern thinkers in the West were closer to Native American thinking than our modern thinkers. And the core of that is that cosmology and creation, nature, are at the heart of their spirituality. And this is so often missed in the modern context, where everything is set up in terms of the human and not in terms of the sacredness of the rest of creation.
This is Progressive Spirit. I'm John Schenck. This is a rebroadcast of a conversation with Matthew Fox. We discuss his 2016 book, A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. More after the break. I'm speaking with Matthew Fox. He's the author of A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. And I highlighted this passage. You write that prayer is, quote, a radical response to life, wherein prayer is understood to be both our mystical root response to life, our yes, and our prophetic root response to life, our no. And so this is the mystical and the prophetic coming together. Often they're seen as opposites, right? You're either contemplative or you're active in the world. You're a beer or a doer. But you talk about prayer here as a response to life, as a prophetic aspect of that. In what ways did Merton pray in this sense that you're talking about?
Well, of course, he had many years of contemplative practice as a Trappist monk, and Trappists are very strict order. They get up in the middle of the night to chant psalms and so forth, and they try not to talk to each other very much. So the whole sense of silence is something they carry through the day and night as much as they can. And he himself spent 6 years pleading with the abbot to give him permission to leave the big monastery and live in a hermitage on the monastery grounds. And finally, he won that argument, and he became a hermit, if you will, and much closer to nature and to the simple life. But again, as we said earlier, he became very prophetic in his last years, not only because he was reaching out to other religions, and in the 1960s, this was very pioneer work, of course, but also because, and of course, he practiced yoga, and he practiced, he practiced photography as a meditation experience too. And but also, as I said, he became very prophetic. He not only stood up against the Vietnam War, but when Rachel Carson's book came out, Silent Spring, which is acknowledged often as the kickoff of the environmental movement, came out in 1962 or 63, she was immediately fired by her science faculty at the university. And they said she was, quote, an hysterical woman in love with bunnies and trees. Well, Merton, in contrast, read the book immediately and wrote her a three-page letter praising her to the sky, saying because of her analysis, they were going to cease using DDT on the monastery farm, and that because of her analysis, now he understood why the birds were disappearing on the land where they lived, because when he arrived in 1940, they were everywhere. So he was out front on the ecology movement also. And the women's movement, he was very supportive. He was in a very profound correspondence with Rosemary Ruther, who was only 28-year-old theologian at the time, a Catholic feminist theologian. He was like 50 or 51, and they had this correspondence going for a year, and she was very hard on him, actually. But he was humble enough to listen and to take it, but also to give some feedback himself. But these are examples of the prophetic prayer, and I appreciate the quote that you offered from my own work, that yes, I'm trying, for my whole life I've been trying to bring together the contemplative and the active, the mystical, right, and the prophetic. That to me is the dance that we all have to do, and that Merton came to the prophetic kind of later in his life, and he was well grounded in the contemplative. But I think today I meet a lot of young people who in a previous era might have been drawn to be monks or nuns, but in this time they're feeling the need to be in the world and to develop both the contemplative and the prophetic side. And this is not just Catholic people. I meet evangelicals. I meet Protestants who are studying the monastic tradition, and people like Thomas Merton, to learn more about the contemplative side, because that has been undertaught in the Protestant traditions, which, after all, were birthed in the modern era. And the modern era was very anti-mystical. It doesn't even understand what mysticism is. But these young people are asking these questions. But they feel called to be activists, but they don't want to be superficial activists, what I would call operating just out of the reptilian brain. They want to operate out of something deeper than just an action, reaction, response. And that something deeper is the contemplative or mystical side of life and of our brains and of our capacities to bring heart and wisdom, not just knowledge, to the struggle.
We are recording this conversation just a few days away from the election. It's been pointed out by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And others that not one question was asked in any of the general election debates about climate change. And we learned a lot about Trump's sexual bravado and Clinton's email account, but not much about whether the human species has a future. if you could channel him, what do you think Thomas Merton would say about the United States of America and its leadership?
Oh, my God. I'm not sure it would be printable. But I couldn't agree more with Amy Goodman, and said I've used that very phrase in my own lectures, you know, because I noticed it myself without hearing it from someone else, because I was watching those debates. Mm-hmm. Not one question about the environment. It just proves Pope Francis's point that our species is in a state of narcissism. We think we're the only ones that count. Well, I'll tell you, I was on a conference in January in Florida on climate change and seas rising. And at that time, the governor of Florida and two presidential candidates from Florida were all three in denial about climate change. All three of them. These are the big shots of the political arena in Florida. Meanwhile, in South Miami, I was there, there's 6 inches of water on the sidewalks. And of course, at this conference, this first speaker was a scientist who got up and showed slides of Florida today, 10 years from now, chop, 20 years from now, chop, chop, 30 years from now, chop, chop, chop. I mean, it's just so obvious. Florida is a canary in the mine. Florida is going to be underwater. And it's not just about getting your feet wet. It's about the salt water invading freshwater wells. And also, what do you do with sewage when the water is higher than the land? So it's just appalling. Appalling, appalling. And that's why what's going on at Standing Rock is so important, because the native people, of course, from thousands of years of experience, are just reminding us in a nonviolent way that water is more sacred than Wall Street. And that's what's at the bottom of all this. We have to admit we're living in a capitalist bubble that is bursting and leaking all over the place. And the idea that humans are all that count, and our little accounting papers, pages, and numbers are all that count, this is obscene. And the Pope has said so in his very important encyclical Laudate Si, which, by the way, was written by one of my students. 80% of it was written by a student of mine who went through my master's program in creation spirituality. By the way, I want to mention, we're starting up a new school. Some students of mine are starting up a new school. It's going to be started up in Boulder next spring, called the Fox Institute for Creation Spirituality. It'll offer master's degrees, certificates, and doctor of ministry and a doctor of spirituality. And I'm very excited about that. They're going about it in a very sound and professional way. But they'll be using the pedagogy that I developed over 35 years to combine this, what we've been talking about, the mysticism and the prophecy, the contemplation and the action. That's what this school will be all about. So I'm excited about that, too.
Oh, I am excited about that. That's the first I've heard of it, because then that will be taking what you already presented in the University of Creation Spirituality and
exactly.
Bringing it in place.
Exactly. Yeah. Using that pedagogy, mm-hmm. Some of our faculty, but of course, a new generation of faculty as well. And I'll teach in it, too. But it's exciting because more and more young people, I sense, are being called to what we're talking about, to this call to defend Mother Earth. And yeah. And from all traditions, including no particular religious tradition, atheists have this call as much as believers have this call. So there's a whole opportunity here for us to join hands at this time in history to wage this struggle, which is not just about the environment, it's also about our institutions, our schools, our religions, our economic system, our political system. All of it needs reinventing today. Creativity is as I say, the one thing our species is going for it. And we've got to unleash the creativity, and we also have to do our inner work. So we're not just projecting, we're not just working out of anger, but we're actually working out of a deeper and more quiet place that contemplation takes us to.
Yeah, and you've used the phrase deep ecumenism. And we talked about that just a second ago with Thomas Merton. And I'm going back to that because you mentioned of younger people, atheists, whatever the tradition is, how important that is, because it's been, again, so bifurcated between, you know, religion and secular or whatever. But Thomas Merton himself saw the connection between his own faith and Buddhism. And there's something deep about that that we're getting in touch with beyond the religious labels.
Well, that's right. And that's why I prefer to use the word spirituality to mm-hmm. religion. I think that spirituality is a broader term, and it's about what's at the essence of all our religions. And it's interesting, in the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas, who, by the way, was an activist as well as being a profound intellectual and mystic, we know he was an activist because he got condemned three times after he died by the bishops. So he must have been doing something interesting. And he says the essence of religion is gratitude. That's what religion is all about. The virtue, he calls it, it's part of the virtue of gratitude. So notice, he's not saying it's about buildings or popes or bishops or schools or radio programs. It's about gratitude. And I think that's really important, because that takes us right into spirituality, because gratefulness is really the first step of our response to awe and to wonder, is gratitude for being here. And I think that science assists with this so much today. For example, just 2 weeks ago, we heard news from science that we don't live in a world of 100 or a couple hundred billion galaxies. We live in a world of 2 trillion galaxies. Now, this is brand new information. But if that's not enough to take the top of your head off, I say, you've been watching too much TV. 2 trillion galaxies. Think about that. We can't even begin to count all the stars and the planets and all those. So my point is, real religion begins with awe, and awe morphs into reverence, respect, and into gratitude. When you have this gratitude, then you're filled. You're full up. Thankfulness is our phrase. Now, you can't be half full of things. So that's the real essence, I think, of being on this earth. It's being grateful for being part of this journey, 13.8 billion year journey, in a home of 2 trillion galaxies. You know, how could we ever be bored again? Our hearts should be exploding with gratitude, and that should shift our consciousness and our conversations, our dialogues and our debates about a creativity that has to follow. But we have to do a deeper examination of our own capacity for evil as a species. Just a day ago, I got this great quote from Jung. He says, "We need more understanding of human nature, because the only real danger that exists is man himself. He is the great danger. We are pitifully aware of it. We know nothing of man, far too little. His psyche should be studied, because we are the origin of all coming evil." Now, that phrase, that section from Jung parallels perfectly what Thomas Merton says, when he says that in his day, you know, the big technological gee whiz event was getting to the moon. But he was not on board with all of that. He said, "What good is it if we get to the moon? If even ants can fly, we can sail all over the universe," he says. "But if we don't deal with human nature and our capacity for evil and destroying each other, we're just going to be taking this shadow all over the universe with us. We'll fly it around Venus," he says. Man is the saddest animal, he says, and we have to deal with this sadness, our inability to taste joy. I think that combination of Merton and Jung is very important. We have to deal with the issues of evil. And so, like a fellow whom I admire a lot, this Musk fellow who's founded an electric car company and all that. But just this last month, he was on there talking about going to Mars. No, I don't think it's premature to go to Mars. We're going to take all our wars to Mars with us? Come on, are you kidding me? Why doesn't Silicon Valley he put some of his money and others in Silicon Valley, put some money into what Jung and Merton are talking about, which is reexamining the human condition and drawing on all our spiritual traditions and techniques from Native American to others to find how we can tame the reptilian brain in the human so that when we do go to other planets, we go as responsible carriers of the best of humanity and not just bringing more trouble with us at great expense. And who's going to pay for all these trips to Mars, too?
Yeah. So, well, bringing war to Mars is a wonderful irony, but yeah,
isn't it? Yeah,
but
exactly.
But you're exactly right, though. The technology serves the empire, and it serves war, and until we move beyond that, our technology will serve, all our creativity will end up serving the worst aspect of us, unless we have this transformation, which really is, as you've written before, we don't have a healthy via positiva, a healthy awe. No. And so therefore, we don't even have a healthy absence of the awe, too.
But exactly. Now, here's Merton's words. His words are always so good because he's a marvelous wordsmith and poet. What can we gain by sailing to the moon if we are not able to cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves? This is the most important of all voyages of discovery. Without it, all the rest are not only useless, but disastrous. So that's what I would like to send, that sentence plus Jung's, to Musk and other Silicon Valley leaders. You know, I respect a lot of their accomplishments, but also remember this: every gadget that comes out of Silicon Valley, ISIS gets hold of within a few months, and then they use it for whatever they want. This fellow who murdered 50 people at a gay club in Orlando, he was texting and he was on Facebook while he was machine gunning these people. So clearly gadgets and technology is not going to save the human species. And it was Rabbi Heschel who said this decades ago, just like Merton did. Heschel said, humanity will not be saved by more information, but by more appreciation. So that's what I'm talking about. That's what Merton's talking about. And I think we have to shake up the liberal establishment to think deeper rather than just coming up with new gadgets to make more money for people who already have enough money. And of course, they make headlines. This Mars trip is all over PBS and everything, but I don't see anything on PBS that's really doing that much to examine the issues that Jung and Merton are talking about examining the abyss that separates us from ourselves. And as Merton says, this is the most important of all discoveries, and it's the hardest journey. And I you even have to ask, are these other so-called journeys like going to Mars a distraction? Because we're afraid to face ourselves, and especially men are afraid to face themselves and find what's really noble inside. So we want to make these outer journeys that make headlines and, of course, are complicit to the, as you say, the empire, and, of course, the empire's media, whose bottom line is, of course, making money. Was it the president of ABC this year said, of course, Donald Trump is dangerous to the country, but he's great for our bottom line. That's why they gave him so much extra airtime, free airtime, because he was good for the bottom line. Well, I mean, that's almost a confession of treason. He doesn't care what happens to the country as long as he's got a his own healthy bottom line. That's obscene. It's not human. It's as immoral as you can get. And these are people sitting on the top of our skyscrapers making decisions for us. And, of course, buying judges and legislators, making the kind of laws that allow Donald Trump to go along without paying any income taxes for 18 years. You know, this is why people are angry. This is even why some people are voting for Donald Trump, because they're pissed off. Well, I'm pissed off, too, but I don't see Donald Trump as the answer. I thought Bernie Sanders had by far the better conclusions. But an awful lot of people in the middle, left and right, don't have a clue what moral outrage is about and say they do not really understand what this election is really trying to teach us, that the moral outrage is out there. Anger matters. And those who are real comfortable don't want to see any anger. And so that's why it's the lower classes that are disturbing the peace here, whether from the left or the right. And that's how it's always been. Change comes from the oppressed, not from the oppressor.
I'm John Schuck, and I'm speaking with Matthew Fox, author of A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey. Let's talk more about moral outrage. How can we use moral outrage creatively? Rather than simply vent and be destructive, how can moral outrage be channeled for transformation?
Well, first of all, I think we have to be careful of bad spiritual teaching that says that anger is a negative thing. Again, that's fall redemption teaching. That was Augustine. Whereas Aquinas said, who's in the grace spiritual tradition, he said, nothing great happens without anger. So anger is this fire that that allows us to persevere in the struggle. And moral outrage is found in the third chakra. It's in our gut. And of course, look at it. Most of our education it does not deal with the lower chakras. It only deals with thinking from the neck up. It's Descartes saying truth is clear and distinct ideas. Well, it isn't. It's also clear and distinct feeling kicked in your gut because you've experienced injustice, or you know you can see others who are experiencing injustice. So a part of dealing with anger is to pay more attention to our lower chakras, and that includes our moral outrage of the third chakra, but also our first chakra connection to the universe and to the earth, because it's about vibration, and all things in the universe, every atom in the universe is vibrating. It's all making music. So that's an invitation to connect to the earth because the first chakra is engaged by dancing. That's why indigenous people dance when they pray. And that's how you connect to the sacredness of the earth. So we're not going to be dealing with ecology just with our head and with numbers. We also have to reconnect to the sacredness of the earth. And sacred dance is an example of that. And of course, our second chakra is our sexuality. I don't think anyone can claim that the West has dealt healthily with sexuality. And that's why these stories are now emerging, now that we have a woman running for president, about the habitual sexual malfeasance, not only of a particular presidential candidate, but of all kinds of power people. Look at Ellis, who just got fired from Fox News for his abuse of women at the workplace, and all these other stories that are coming out. You know, there's a lot more sexism going on than has made the media clearly. All these stories coming out. So when sexuality is not healthy, it becomes one more power trip. So so abuse of sexuality is invariably a power trip, and so it's one more critique we have to make of our the way we live on the earth, and the way we're alienated from our own natures. And religion's done a bad job, I think, especially the Christian religion in the West, reminding us of the sacred power of sexuality. The sexuality is a power. It's not something you repress. It's not something you forget on the one hand, but it's also not something you want to abuse. And of course, the whole pedophile priest story is horrible, and especially the cover up it by hierarchy. That's the worst part of all, is that cover up, all in the name of the institutional image. So all this is now coming out today, and Jung predicted this about the age of Aquarius. He said that evil would no longer be under the table; it would be above the table. But the question would be, would we have the will to deal with it? And I think a lot of these issues are arising today, and it's like pus coming out of a sore. You know, it's not pretty, but it's probably a very good thing, because we can start talking more frankly about reality now. And again, I think someone like Bernie Sanders has done a great service by naming not just the pus, but also some avenues for medicine, to apply medicine to this, to the sores that we're all carrying around with us. And I think that, remember that Augustine came along in the 4th century at the time that Christianity inherited the empire. So a lot of his theology is kind of a manual on how to run an empire in the name of religion. And I think that his repression of sexuality plays a real big role in that, and his repression of anger. Because moral outrage, you know, Jesus had moral outrage. He flipped the tables there with the moneylenders in the temple. And in fact, scholars today tell us that he didn't do it alone. He created an action. he had dozens and dozens of helpers doing this. So it was what we would call an action today, an event. Of course, there was no TV to pick it up, but it was an event, and the word got around. This was an event. You don't do this in the temple, but he did it. He stirred things up there, and of course, it had everything to do with his crucifixion, with their killing him, because it angered not only the religious establishment, but the political establishment, the empire that was in cahoots with the religious establishment. Both ends were upset by his what he did, by that event, and I think it had everything to do with his death. Yeah, we want to steer our moral outrage. So, and that's where nonviolence comes in. I mean, that's what Gandhi did. It's what King did, isn't it? They harnessed, they corralled the moral outrage of blacks in the South who've been living long enough with abuse after the war, but also after the Civil War, but also Gandhi dealing with his countrymen, dealing with the abuse of the colonial empire, the English. But they, instead of just letting it turn into more anger and venting, which is kind of Donald Trump's way, just stirring the anger and getting scapegoats. And of course, Hitler dealt with that way too. Instead of that, they had a purpose. They had a design that was positive about how to organize this anger. So King filling the jails and marching and doing the sit-ins, all that was dealing with anger in a positive way, in a nonviolent way, not returning violence for violence. And that was his success. That was his power. And the same method, of course, he learned from Gandhi, because it worked with Gandhi too.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck, and I'm speaking with Matthew Fox. This is a rebroadcast of an interview I had with him in November 2016. Progressive Spirit is heard every week on several radio stations across the country. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. If you enjoy the show, ask your local public radio station to check it out and consider adding Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed through Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and the Pacifica Radio Network. You can also catch Progressive Spirit on podcast. Hear it on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear and listen on iTunes or Stitcher or any app that has a place for a review, please leave one. More reviews help the show get a wider audience. If you have ideas for guests or would like to comment on an episode, contact me through my website, progressivespirit.net. You can comment on Facebook and retweet on Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.